The Forest Uncle.
This sounds outlandish, but I promise it's the truth. I've lived with my Uncle Ty in his cabin since the age of 6. He's always been an outdoorsy kind of guy. Where his cabin is located, it's relatively secluded with miles between him and his neighbors, which may be why he taught me how to survive should I get lost at such a young age. Well, at 11, there was a day that I will never forget. It starts like this. I got lost. Maybe got a little too distracted playing with my handball and wandered too far into the forest. I felt scared looking around. All of it was just trees. Then I fell to my knees. That's when I heard a, hey. When looking up, there was a man standing in the clearing. Most probably would have freaked out in this situation, but the guy looked and sounded exactly like my Uncle Ty. However, there was an unnatural sense of peace as he smiled at me. Carefully raising an arm, he proceeded to gesture over to a particular tree with a red ribbon tied around its middle. Time to head on home, little one. Just follow the ribbons. Uncle's been awfully worried about you. At first, I couldn't move, even when feeling a sense of safety, at least until he spoke again. Go on now. He's waiting for you. His voice was strangely gentle and smooth as he encouraged me to leave. In that moment, I couldn't quite understand why there wasn't the faintest hint of fear in me. What I do know is that I felt compelled to obey his words. I casually strolled past the guy, not daring to look at him or retrieve my ball, consistently scanning the trees for more red ribbons and following them back to the cabin. My uncle immediately charged me as soon as I opened the door. He asked where I had been, and that the sun was setting. Apparently, I was playing longer than anticipated. During that time, Uncle Ty was cooking some stir-fry. I didn't get much sleep that night, but when I got out of bed the next day, there my ball was, right beside my desk. During breakfast, I asked my uncle if he found it, only for him to tell me that no, he didn't find it. Apparently, he didn't know I'd lost it to begin with. But there it was, placed directly next to my desk, not a speck of dirt staining the surface. During school holidays when I was 14, Uncle Ty left to go help his mate out with moving. He left me alone for the afternoon. At that point, I didn't think much of that other encounter, and I developed a new love of drawing. I wanted to draw some of the trees by a creek located not too far from the cabin. I've been using it as a landmark checkpoint of the area to determine the distance of the cabin and myself. It's a special place for me. I stood by a certain tree situated a couple of meters away from the little creek with my sketchbook and pencil. Then, the tree I was posted on started to collapse. I didn't notice it until after. In fact, in the heat of the moment, I thought someone was trying to kidnap me because there was a set of warm hands that picked me up and tossed me out of the way. When I finally could get my head together again, there was my uncle. He appeared much closer to me than the previous encounter. Again, I felt calm. It didn't register at the time that this could have been the same person who saved me a couple of years prior. He even had the same exact scar as Uncle Ty, just below the eye. Silently, I asked him, "How'd you know I was here?" He smiled. I immediately felt a strong sense of peace, not too sure how else to describe it. He wasn't a ghost either. His hands were solid and warm. I felt them help me up. Still, something in my mind told me this isn't Uncle Ty. He said, "Gotta get home now. Uncle's about to look for you." He was right. As soon as I arrived back to the cabin, my uncle was already rushing down the driveway with a flashlight. Uncle Ty said that when he got back, I wasn't there, which was normal, but apparently the sun set and I still didn't come back, so he was about to head out. That was odd, though, considering it felt as though it'd only been a half hour. As for my sketchbook, I found it the next day. It was in pristine condition, but there was curvy writing on the corner that read, "I like drawing, too." To this day, I don't know who or what I saw in the forest that day. To be honest, it's something I can live without knowing.
Welcome to the True Scary Stories with Edie podcast. This is the podcast where two stand-up comedians read scary stories that are submitted to us by our fans, the Uglies. What's up, guys? And some of these stories we find scoured all over the world, including places like Reddit. Mostly yes. Places like Reddit. This is a podcast that has commentary after every story. So if you're not into that, you should check out our other podcast called Just the Terror. And it's here where you're listening to Two Scary Stories with Edie. If you'd like to submit your scary story, you can do it on the Facebook group, the Instagram, or on the website. All at Two Scary Stories with Edie.
Yeah, there you go. You did it.
I know. I'm getting real good. Yeah,
we've got to make sure we're not moving the table too much. Sorry. They might hear it.
I was giving Nick a side hug for a great story.
Yeah.
All right. So what I think about this is it wasn't creepy until the fact that the guy said, I like to draw too.
I like to draw too.
Yeah. That, I was like, oh, this is a nice story. He's like, I like to draw too. And I was like, oh, it puts the lotion on its skin. this is like a turning into a scary, terrible thing.
Yeah.
I have no idea what it could be. Nick, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I don't know either. I read some comments on the story where people are like, well, maybe it was a past relative trying to check on you that just took the form of your uncle.
The fact that he thought it was so, like...
peaceful?
No, like, he really felt the person, and he could even say, like, there was a scar.
Yeah.
That to me is, like, it's giving me more than ghost, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because he did say that, and this was, again, in another comment, he wouldn't say why he lived with his uncle. He just said that I lived with my uncle because of reasons I don't want to explain.
Oh, right. So you think maybe it's his dad.
Or I was thinking that maybe it was his uncle's energy of I need to protect this kid is so strong that his uncle has a strong energy that watches him.
And his uncle's energy is so cool, it has a scar.
Yes.
that's pretty bad boy. I like that.
Yeah, so who knows? It could just be his uncle doesn't even know how strong he is.
What about his uncle had a twin that he ate in the tummy?
Okay.
And then that's how he got the scar.
Yeah.
Okay,
all right. The twin scratched at him in the tummy?
Yeah.
Okay.
He said, all right, I'll always protect your nephew because of this.
Oh, okay.
All right,
this is all said in the mother's womb.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This was even before that. This was just when they were eggs.
Oh, okay.
This went over easy.
Life starts at the eggs.
Right. Yeah. I know that's kind of a...
over easy, you silly. Okay, I heard what you said.
Sorry. I thought that was an excellent joke.
Yes, it was very good. Are you a Batman villain?
No.
Well, there was one called Eggman.
I thought there was the mystery one. What was his name?
The mystery one.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Quizzler?
The Quizzler. The Riddler?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Sorry, my brain was scrambled.
Okay.
Okay, we gotta stop. All right. All right, we're on to today's topic, which is missing. The first story is called A Terrifying Backwoods Find.
Growing up in a backwoods town, you would never expect anything horrible to happen. Somerset was a relatively small and quiet town. Plenty of beautiful and tranquil sights to see in the woods. But unfortunately, that isn't the case. There's always seemed to be something hidden within the forest. We begin this story with a friend named Logan. Logan was a lot younger than the rest of us. He really only hung out with myself and a friend named Shelly. We used to hang out at Shelly's and take care of horses, hike, and ride four-wheelers through the woods. Logan, as most kids, was pretty annoying. Nothing too bad, always obnoxious, loud, and would tell some really gross jokes. But for a teenager, it was sometimes just a bit much to be around. But he was a family friend of Shelly, so we were kind of stuck with him. One day, Shelly and I were hanging out at her place, playing Majora's Mask for the umpteenth time. When her home phone rang, Shelly answered. After a few moments of silence, I look over to see her face has gone white. I heard her mutter something along the lines of, "Yeah, that's fine. You can come here." The whole time, I'm impatiently mouthing, "What's up? What happened?" Eventually, Shelly hung up. After about half an hour, we got a knock at the door. It's Logan. His face was pale, like he had been throwing up or something. It was frozen in an expression of shock. We went to Shelly's room while Logan's mom talked to Shelly's mom. We just sat there in silence for what felt like an hour until I finally asked what happened. Shelly punched me and whispered, "Dude." Then Logan looked up at me and began his story. The following account is from Logan's perspective. Dad and I were riding the trails like we usually do out in the woods behind our house. We're maybe 20 minutes into the ride. We came across a trail by the creek. Dad told me to turn off so we can go mudding. I followed him. We went off onto the creek trail. were on for about a minute before we came across a flat spot that looked like it might have been a campsite. Once we reached this section in the woods, I noticed an awful smell. We went to drive by it. Just as we reached the edge of the site, I hit a bump, something that shifted the four-wheeler. As that happened, I noticed a large metal barrel near the center of the site. My dad kept driving by it and was ready to continue on the path, but I was curious. It had scratch marks at the top, scorch marks too. So someone used it as a fire pit. So I drove over to the barrel. As I got closer, I noticed the stench got even worse. Then I looked inside. As I looked at the contents of the barrel, I saw it was a body, headless, burned, and stuffed into the barrel. Now, at this point in Logan's retelling of the story, he became quiet again. He was crying and stopped telling his story. I didn't want to pry anymore, so we comforted him as best as we could. Hearing news reports later, we found out that the body was a local man, Kevin Price. Logan and his dad had come across the dump site of his body. The police report read, "On November 9, 2009, Kevin Price was last seen leaving work at 3:30 p.m. from Eagle Hardwood, just north of Somerset. When he didn't return home, family members became concerned and reported him missing. Later in the evening, Kevin Price's silver Dodge Dakota was found burning near the former Outdoorsman Club pond behind Eagle Hardwood. On November 28, 2009, Kevin Price's burned body was located in a remote area off Strawberry Road in eastern Pulaski County. His death had been ruled a homicide. It has been almost 13 years since he was murdered. As stated earlier, police were never able to solve the case. And to date, the public still doesn't know who committed this horrible act or why it happened. But one thing is for sure. There are sometimes more terrifying things than monsters in the backwoods of Somerset."
All right. Well, luckily I'll never be there in the backwoods of Somerset.
No.
And then I look at my calendar and it's like, show in the backwoods of Somerset.
Oh, there you go. Yay.
You know, right next to the barrels.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, definitely there are very many murders that happen and bodies are usually dumped somewhere like in the woods or something like that. So somebody's got to find him. And I guess, unfortunately, it was this kid.
Nick, poor kid.
Right. At least they could identify who it was and give the family some closure. But what else do you think about this story, Nick?
Well, that's what we're talking about. Missing people. So, you know, this is exactly it. This is all true crime stuff.
Yes. A lot of these stories are going to be kind of spooky, but also kind of sad. And so we're going to try to handle it with as much respect as we can.
Yeah.
So all of these stories are told with the deepest respect. And I'm excited to get into some of these mysteries.
Yeah.
All right. The Milk Carton Boys.
It's a story that shocked communities and catapulted Iowa into the national spotlight. Change state law and forever change the way parents monitored their children's activities. On a Sunday morning, September 5th, 1982, 12-year-old Des Moines Register paperboy Johnny Gosch left his West Des Moines home to begin his paper route. He wore a white sweatshirt with Kim's Academy on the back, warm-up pants, blue rubber flip-flops, and carried a yellow paper bag. Normally, his father, John Gosch, accompanied him on the route, but on this day, Johnny went alone. He never came home. What happened after that has been the subject of speculation for more than three decades. In a November 11, 2010 interview, the day before Johnny would have celebrated his 41st birthday, Johnny's mother, Noreen Gosch, told reporter Aaron Brillbeck that several other paper boys, all witnesses to the abduction, said Johnny was approached by a man driving a blue Ford Fairmont. The guy shut off his engine, opened the passenger door, and swung his feet out on the curb right where the boys were assembling their newspapers. And he started talking about, "Where's 86th Street? Johnny turned to Mike and said, "I've got my papers loaded in the wagon. I'm scared. I'm getting out of here. I'm going to head home." The boys recounted to the police at the time that as Johnny left, the driver of the car took off too. The man pulled the door shut, started up the engine. But before he left, he reached up and flicked the dome lights three times, then he pulled out and left. Noreen said she believes the driver was signaling another person who later grabbed Johnny. Also, one of the paperboys saw a tall man come out from in between two houses and follow her son. West Des Moines Police Lieutenant Jeff Miller, a rookie cop at the time, told Brillbeck Police began scouring the area immediately, but hit one wall after another. Miller remembered they went ahead and called in the staff, the troopers, they called in the detectives, reserves, contacted Polk County Sheriffs, the State Patrol. At that point, they did a door-to-door canvas of that neighborhood trying to find someone who saw something of Johnny. Nothing was found, and they saw nothing at all. 1 month after her son's disappearance, Noreen founded the Johnny Gosch Foundation and also developed a program called In Defense of Children. She began touring the nation, making nearly 1,000 personal appearances with law enforcement, missing persons organizations, those involving human trafficking, and doing whatever she could to increase overall awareness of crimes involving children. On July 1, 1984, a bill she authored, the Johnny Gosch Bill, was passed into Iowa law. It mandated immediate police involvement whenever a child went missing and was subsequently and was immediately adopted by 8 additional states. That same year, she traveled to Washington, D.C. and testified before Congress during hearings on organized crime. Her testimony, she said, led to death threats and also, in part, the eventual establishment of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. President Ronald Reagan invited her to the center's opening and dedication. In the interim, 2 more young Des Moines boys also vanished under mysterious circumstances. On August 12, 1984, 13-year-old paperboy Eugene Martin vanished from Des Moines' south side. On March 29, 1986, 13-year-old Mark Allen told his mother he planned to walk to a friend's house down the street, but never arrived at the neighbor's home and hasn't been seen since. Not quite 2 years after Eugene Martin's disappearance. Mark Allen's mother, Nancy Allen, has stated she doesn't know whether her son's disappearance is linked to the disappearance of either Johnny Gosch or Eugene Martin, but felt police were reluctant to pursue her son's case because of the other 2 missing boys. I got the distinct feeling police did not want parents to be frightened to let their children sell newspapers or do different things. After Eugene Martin disappeared in 1984, a relative working at Anderson and Erickson Dairy in Des Moines reached out to company president Jim Erickson for help. The Register had run full-page ads with the boys' pictures and information. A local trucking company had put poster-sized images of the boys on the sides of their truck. That same month, Anderson and Erickson Dairy began running photos and short bios about the boys on the sides of Dairy's half-gallon milk cartons. It got the boys' faces into thousands of area homes every morning. 1 week after Anderson and Erickson Dairy launched their milk carton program, Prairie Farms Dairy in Des Moines decided to do the same, and the project soon exploded on a nationwide basis. Now, even though many good things happened because of these terrible cases, Noreen Gosch was still haunted by the disappearance of her son. Early one September morning in 2006, more than 2 decades after, Noreen Gosch said a mysterious envelope showed up on her front doorstep. Inside, she said, she found 3 disturbing photos of several boys all tied up. One of the boys appeared to be Johnny. Gosch recalled to the reporter, I literally could not breathe. I could not get my breath. I was so totally unprepared to see something like that. All these years had gone by and here was this picture. The image in question depicted a young boy hogtied and wearing only his underpants and socks. Gosch took the photos to West Des Moines Police Department. When I did, we spread them out and the detective kept saying, that's Johnny, that's Johnny. I said, I know that's Johnny. The press went wild. Newspapers and television stations across the country reported Gosch's story. Then came a call from West Des Moines police who told Gosch they were planning a press conference of their own. They planned to announce the pictures weren't of Johnny after all. I said that picture's Johnny, and the detective said to me, well, somebody from Florida called in and said he used to be an investigator and remembered the pictures from a case in 1970-something, Gosch said. Noreen Gosch said she asked the detective if the caller provided them with any evidence. He responded with no, telling her they just had the phone call. Noreen confronted the detective. And based on his phone call, you're doing a press conference and say that picture's not Johnny? And he said, well, yes, I am. To this day, Gosch believes the boy in the photo was her son and that he was bound and gagged and abused. Police continue to insist it's not him. Lieutenant Miller told the reporter, we found where the photos were taken. We talked with the investigators in Florida. They were able to identify all the kids in the picture, and they weren't Johnny Gosch. Asked about what would have been her son's 41st birthday, Noreen said she often thinks about what his life would have been like had it not been for that fateful day in 1982. He would have gone on, probably found the love of his life, maybe hopefully settled down, had a family, an interesting career that he enjoyed like his siblings. You want the best for your child. And the sad thing is that all of that was robbed from him. Those years are missing. That clock stopped at 12 years old for us. Yet, there was a bizarre encounter in all of this. Back in March 1997, 15 years after Johnny Gosch's disappearance, Noreen Gosch awoke to a knock on her door at 2:30 a.m. Although the unexpected visitor pulled open his shirt to reveal a familiar birthmark on his chest, Noreen claimed she recognized the visitor right away. The man was her now 27-year-old Johnny. According to Noreen, he was accompanied by a man she had never seen before. Although she spoke with her son for over an hour, Johnny would look over to the other person for approval to speak. The long-missing boy supposedly told his mother he was still in danger and refused to disclose where he was living before vanishing once again. Johnny also told her not to disclose that he was alive or would put their lives into danger. So Noreen kept it a secret at the time, even from her own husband. It was in 1999 that she finally told anyone.
All right. So this was brought to our attention as one of the like creepiest missing persons cases. And I think gets that from the fact that the mother says that her son came back as an adult after he had been missing for 15 years, came back with his handlers who have abducted him. She thinks it was for trafficking.
Yeah.
So if what she's saying is true, that means he's still alive. He's been trafficked this whole time. And the people who were trafficking him let him have a meeting with his mom as an adult. Now, I don't see what reason she would have to lie about this.
Yeah.
I can see a reason why they wouldn't have proof. Because it's like they want it. But I don't see a reason why they would let him go see his mom. Just to be like, I'm okay, but, you know, my life is just not good.
Well, I have my ideas.
Go for it.
So, you know, this case was basically what started the milk carton thing.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Actually, I think I've seen a movie about this too.
Yeah. So this is what started that movement. And prior to this, there was no real idea about child abduction and child sex trafficking. So this also kind of launched it to the point where you saw she got laws passed. She went to go to the president, you know, showed it to the government. Well, when you're in that spotlight pursuing things that are, you know, against very dark, very hardcore criminals, they're going to send little messages to you. And whether this was actually Johnny or somebody they forced to pretend to be Johnny just to kind of traumatize her, which they even sent pictures later on, you know, 2006. So 1997 was when the Johnny supposedly came to visit her. And then 2006, she got the pictures. So it's almost like there could be this criminal organization, these criminals that keep harassing her because she brought to spotlight something that wasn't like, thought about before.
Yeah, like maybe be quiet because we still have him.
Yes.
And it also like makes me think of like all the killers, the serial killers who send in clues to the newspapers and stuff like that, like the Zodiac Killer, who it's like, what's your purpose for doing that? You got away with it, you know?
Yeah.
And the purpose is because that's the whole name of the game.
Yeah.
And that's how usually they get sloppy, is because they have that impulse. All right.
Yeah, so that's what I think. Either she had a crazy dream and just believed it because she wanted to, or she's just being taunted by
this whole story reminds me of another one I'm going to tell you in this next part.
Oh.
All right, we've tried to do this three times with me. With me saying this story about Christine Collins, which is a very famous case. She is missing her son, and it was mostly famous because of the movie The Changeling with Angelina Jolie. You know it, right?
Yeah.
All right, good. Strike three. All right, so March 10th, 1928, Christine Collins gives her son, who's 9, some money for the cinema, and he never returns back. So she reports him missing, and this is in Los Angeles. They're looking, and they have like the police have a lot of pressure to solve this case. So what they do is they find a boy who says, "Yeah, that's me." And they bring the boy to her, and she's like, that's not my son. And they're like, what do you mean? This? He says he's your son. That's your son.
Yeah.
And it got so bad that they even put her in a mental institution. Because I was like, how do you not recognize your own son?
Yeah.
Later, the boy admitted, like, okay, I'm not her son. It turned out to be some boy who had a really hard life. He ran away, and he was just like, I'll be your son.
I'll be whatever you want.
Yeah, and this so happened. They looked a good amount alike. So she keeps looking for her son. She gets out of the psych ward because they find out that that boy's not hers. And she pretty much spends her whole life looking for him. And in a few years later, they find a serial killer who had been killing young boys. He kept them in a chicken coop, and they think that maybe he was abducted by him because they found similar bones with the bones of a ton of other little boys. And some of the boys escaped.
Yeah.
So she never held out. She never gave up hope that he was one of the boys who escaped and was too afraid to come forward.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, just scared.
Just everything he went
through. So, yeah, that's what she believes, is that he's still out there.
Yeah.
But he just he can't come forward. And I think in the movie they said that one of the boys who survived said he was there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that, but that might just be in the movie.
Yeah,
where
yeah,
he's
yeah.
like, he was there. And then in the movie the boy who does escape says that her son helped him escape.
I think I remember that.
That part, yeah. That was like that movie really spooked me out. I'm not sure if that last detail is true, but they think that's what actually happened to her son, that he was abducted by the serial killer, and there were just so many bones that they found at his residence that they couldn't tell if it was him or not. And this was also a long time ago.
Yeah, it was prior, before DNA evidence.
And kind of the moral of the story is that the Los Angeles Police Department, the greatest police department in the universe.
Yeah?
No, I'm just saying they wanted so badly to solve the case, to give everybody peace of mind, that they brought her
a random kid.
Yeah, and didn't listen to her, called her crazy when she was like, that's not my son.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, are you proud of me for remembering all those
that's
details?
Very good, yes. Good job.
Three takes. All right, let's keep going. The Mystery of the Missing Keepers.
In December 1900, a boat called Hesperus set sail for the island of Eileen Moor, one of the seven islets, also known as the Seven Hunters, of the Flannan Isles off the coast of northwestern Scotland. Captain James Harvey was tasked with delivering a relief lighthouse keeper as part of a regular rotation. The journey was delayed a few days by bad weather. And when Harvey and his crew finally arrived, it was clear that something was awry. None of the normal preparations at the landing dock had been made. The flagstaff was bare, and none of the keepers came to greet the Hesperus. The keepers, as it turned out, weren't on the island at all. All three of them had vanished. Eileen Moor had its peculiarities. The island's only permanent residents were sheep, and herders referred to it as the other country, believing it to be a place touched by something paranormal. Eileen Moor had long elicited a sort of fearful reverence in its visitors. The main draw to the remote location was a chapel built in the 7th century by Saint Flannan. Even those who never prayed were moved to worship while on Eileen Moor. Superstitions and rituals, like circling the church's ruins on your knees, were adopted by those passing through. And many considered Eileen Moor to have an indefinable aura that could not be ignored. What the Hesperus crew did find at the lighthouse was a set of perplexing clues. The replacement keeper, Joseph Moore, was the first to investigate and reported an all-encompassing sense of dread as he ascended the cliff toward the newly constructed lighthouse. Inside, the kitchen table contained plates of meat, potatoes, and pickles. The clock was stopped. There was an overturned chair nearby. The lamp was ready for lighting, and two of the three oilskin coats belonging to Thomas Marshall, James Duckett, and Donald MacArthur were gone. The gate and door were firmly shut. These clues only led to more questions. Why would one of the keepers have gone on without his coat? And for that matter, why would all three have left together at all when the rules forbade it? Someone needed to man the post at all times, so something unusual must have drawn them out. When Moore returned with his report, Harvey had the island searched. The hunt came up empty. The captain then sent a telegram to the mainland. A dreadful accident has happened at the Flanagan's. The three keepers, Duckett, Marshall, and the occasional, have disappeared from the island. On our arrival there this afternoon, no sign of life was to be seen on the island. Fired a rocket, but, as no response was made, managed to land Moore, who went up to the station, but found no keepers there. The clocks were stopped, and other signs indicated that the accident must have happened about a week ago. Poor fellas, they must have been blown over the cliff, or drowned trying to secure a crane, or something like that. Night coming on. We not want to wake to make something as to their faith. I have left Moore, McDonald, Boymaster, and two seamen on the island to keep the light burning until you make other arrangements. Seamen, that's the one they got you?
No, the McDonald's.
I've left Moore, McDonald, Boymaster, Buoymaster, maybe it's Buoymaster, and two seamen.
Sorry, Manila.
It's okay. Will not return to Oban until I hear from you. I've repeated this wire to Muirhead in case you are not at home. I will remain at the telegraph office tonight until it closes if you wish to wire me. Further investigations also led nowhere, though the lighthouse logbook provided a new set of confounding details. On December 12th, an entry from Marshall described severe winds, the likes of which I've never seen before in 20 years. He wrote that Ducat had been quiet and MacArthur had been crying, which would have been an odd behavior for a man with a reputation as a tough and experienced seafarer. The next day, Marshall reported more storm details and wrote that all three of them had been praying. Another odd bit of behavior from well-seasoned keepers in a brand-new, supposedly safe lighthouse. Strangest of all, there were no reported storms in the area on December 12th, 13th, 14th. All should have been calmed up until December 17th. The last report in the book from December 15th read, "Storm ended. Sea calm. God is all over." Speculation ran wild. Was it something supernatural? Sea creatures? A case of madness and murder? A government operation? Foreign spies? Aliens? Ultimately, it was evidence outside the lighthouse that provided the most promising lead in explaining what had become of the three keepers. Over at the western landing platform, damage from the recent storms reached as high as 200 feet above sea level. Ropes that were usually affixed to a crate on a supply crane were littered about. Robert Muirhead, superintendent of the Commissioners of Northern Lights, wrote in his official report, "I'm of the opinion that most likely explanation of the disappearance of the men is that they had all gone down on the afternoon of Saturday, 15th of December, to the proximity of the West Landing to secure the box with the mooring ropes, etc. An unexpectedly large roller had come up on the island, and a large body of water going up higher than where they were and coming down upon them had swept them away with resistless force. While this, or a similar approximation, seems possible, the explanation left considerable room for doubt. The lack of bodies, supposedly calm conditions, the sheer experience and know-how of lighthouse keepers still hadn't been accounted for and never would be. In the following years, other keepers claimed to hear voices in the salty air, screaming out the names of Thomas Marshall, James Ducat, and Donald MacArthur."
All right. So I wrote down a couple things for this one. First of all, what a cool story. And of course, Rigby had to glug glug, right?
Yeah.
He loves to drink water right as the story's getting to the part, our dog.
I kept messing up that guy's name, Ducat, Duckett. I don't know what it was.
Okay. So, yeah, very hard to vanish off an island.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going to go? It's got to be something ate you. That's the only way you can vanish is something ate you. Because otherwise, where's the body?
Yeah.
You know? It's very reminiscent of Amelia Earhart and how they think they just found her and that she had crash landed on an island and some crabs ate her. Big crabs that have whole caves that they tunnel. So that's why they never found the bones, because they tunnel and they would be scattered all over the island.
Mm.
So that is really the only thing I can think of why there's no bones. Maybe they had died and then the crabs, coconut crabs, I think that's what they're called. Coconut crabs, big crabs, like gigantic, like the size of a cat. That's the only way you can really vanish is if something ate you.
Yeah.
Besides that, I thought it was kind of weird how they were saying that when people would go there, they would feel the need to worship by getting on their knees and walking around the church. Like, that's a very specific thing, you know? It's like, oh, yeah, everybody did that when they got here for some reason. It's like, yeah, this is a beautiful island. Would you like to get on your knees and walk around? I don't know. I'm just getting this feeling like we should do that. Like, how did they, it was like an instinctual thing. It's like, that's, that to me is like, that ritual is very ominous. Cause it's like, how did you all want to do that? Yeah. Like, yeah, we came here to party, but I really want to get on my knees and walk around the church for a second. You want to do that? Oh yeah, I'd love that. Besides that, I oil skin coat.
Yes.
Well, what? What is an oil skin coat?
Was it maybe like well oil skin? Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just a slang term for like well skin coats.
Right. Imagine wearing a whale.
I probably need it there at the sea and in the cold in the Scotland. I mean, I don't know. We'd have to look up what oil skin whales, coats are.
Oil skin coat. Yeah. I had one of those when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. I had bad acne.
Oh, okay. All right. I didn't know that was
all right. Do you want to say anything about this one?
I mean, you know, everything you said was very, very good possibility, especially now that we are looking at it from 2021. This was 1900. So I think it's funny how they were like, there's no way that a storm could have hit, when it's also like, yeah, but storms are unpredictable.
Right.
And we don't know if this, you know, this area, the reason it felt so ominous and threatening was because for some reason the gravitational pull of the Earth was so strong and just created bigger waves.
Magnets.
Yes.
Tectonic plates.
Yeah. So it's, I wonder if they had science better, they would have known, other than it was just strange here.
Yeah. Because they were relying on a diary.
Yeah.
For the science.
Yes.
Like, I mean, there was no storms. We have the diary.
Yeah.
It's factual.
And they were hoping that, you know, like, you know, Marshall and Ducat and them were like good dudes that are like, yeah, I'm going to write down everything.
Yeah, right. But when stuff really gets scary, who's like, oh man, I feel like a demon is chasing us. Let's write it down. Yeah. Does anyone want to go get on your knees and walk around the church?
What if it was Ursula? And she commanded it to get food.
And she was like, Fletz and Jetson, now I got them, boys. Yep. All right, let's keep going. All right, so one of the most viral missing persons cases right now is the Gabby Petito case. So, where is Gabby?
On July 2nd, 2020, 22-year-old Gabby Petito announced to her Instagram followers that she had said yes to Brian Laundrie's proposal. She posted a picture of their first date, writing in a caption that you make life feel unreal and every day is such a dream without you, or such a dream with you. The following day, Brian started his Instagram account to share the same announcement, writing in a caption, my biggest fear is that one day I'll wake up and it will all have been a dream, because that is what every second has felt like since the moment we found each other, till death do us part, or until I wake up. I'm so happy the answer was yes. Love you, honey. They had already been traveling the U.S. together for more than a year by then, taking cross-country road trips in a Nissan Sentra. On July 2nd, 2021, they decided to ditch the Sentra, downsize their lives, and travel full-time in a van modified for simple living, a lifestyle that became popular through social media under the hashtag vanlife. On August 19th, the couple uploaded a video to YouTube that featured a montage of their travels over the past 2 years. On September 1st, 2021, Brian returned to his parents' place in Northport, Florida, in the van, but he returned alone. The story soon sparked a frenzy on social media. People all over the corners of the internet started doing their own type of detective work, analyzing the YouTube video, looking through all the posts, searching for clues to what they are convinced is a homicide with Brian as the lead suspect. Many of their findings could be written off as mere coincidences, but this frenzy sparked enough of a fire to smoke out some very real clues. The biggest question everyone wanted to answer: where is Gabby?
All right. So this, I feel like this case has just been really thrown in our faces. Like I remember hearing something about it and then just everybody talking about it.
Yeah.
And I'd seen so many TikToks with like little people playing like investigator and giving their own little clues, so I thought it was really interesting with all of the different ideas and evidence everybody was coming up with. What do you think?
I mean, it's an interesting time that we're in where, yes, obviously this is a social media disappearance. So these people were very active on social media. They had their lives out there. So it's easy to dig in. I will say, I think some people went a little too crazy into digging in. But what's wild is because they dug in, because people did post it, other things started coming out, you know, which is a good and a bad of social media. You know, and then we're going to talk more about that.
All right, let's keep going. The domestic dispute.
On August 12th, Melissa Holes, the visitor and response protection supervisor at Arches National Park, heard a call come over her radio of a possible domestic assault. In the recording that was recently released, the caller tells dispatchers, a gentleman was slapping the girl. They ran up and down the sidewalk. He proceeded to hit her, hopped in the car, and they drove off. Melissa Holes hadn't heard the phone call until its release, so she only knew some of what was she heading to. The couple were pulled over for speeding and hitting a curb by a Moab police officer inside the Arches National Park. Body cam footage showed Gabby crying and discussing her mental health with officers. The footage is now a video that millions of Americans have watched. Gabby is seen apologizing multiple times. Brian, soft-spoken, nervous, and also apologetic, sits in the driver's seat as he takes the keys out of the ignition and proceeds to explain why the van hit the curb. Gabby tells the officers, "He really stresses me out. This is a rough morning. I don't know. It's just some days I have really bad OCD. And I was just cleaning and straightening up, and I was apologizing to him. I'm sorry that I'm so mean." Gabby's father has stated that her use of OCD is more of a slang for the OCD than an actual diagnosis. Gabby then details a fight between her and Brian earlier that afternoon, where she says her fiancé tried to lock her out of the car, telling her she needed to calm down. Their stories lined up, with Brian telling officers, "I said, let's just take a breather and let's not go anywhere. Let's just calm down for a minute." Brian then tells police that several scratches on his face were from Gabby hitting him as she tried to get back into the van. A striking image soon emerges, a sobbing Gabby surrounded by male officers. Then Melissa Holes arrives. Knowing that in a domestic violence situation, the female usually feels more comfortable talking with another male, Melissa focused on Gabby, who at that point was sitting in the back of a police cruiser. "I could still hear her voice," Melissa said in an exclusive interview with the Deseret News. "She wasn't just a face on a milk carton. She was real to me. I was probably more candid with her than I should have been. I was imploring with her to reevaluate her relationship, asking her if she was happy in the relationship with him, and basically saying this was an opportunity for her to find another path, to make a change in her life. She had a lot of anxiety about being away from him. Honestly thought if anything was going to change, it would be after they got home to Florida." After consoling Gabby, Holes discussed what to do with her colleagues. They had several options. With the facts suggesting Gabby was the aggressor, they could have taken her to jail. But Melissa said the situation appeared to be more of a mental health crisis than a case of domestic violence. "What Gabby did to Brian was emotional," Holes said. "She shouldn't have done it, but it wasn't done maliciously." In the end, Gabby took most of the blame for the dispute. Police separated the pair for the night, Gabby remaining with a van while Brian checked into a motel. A few days later, they were back on the road, headed north to Salt Lake City. Their social media presence resumed, showing every indication of a happy couple in love and living out the coveted van life. They stopped in Ogden, where Gabby is pictured in front of a butterfly mural, the last thing posted to her Instagram account. A few days later, Gabby texted her mom before the couple reportedly went camping in Wyoming. It was the last time they heard from their daughter. A week later, she was reported missing.
Oh, right. So the body cam footage from the police officer, you can pretty much see it. I mean, if you Google it, you can see it. And it really appears that Gabby is the one who's really upset, while you have Brian kind of like smirking and not really caring about the situation. I also saw something where somebody was saying that he had pulled over in a way that it was so close to like the traffic cones that the cop would have to come to his side because he wanted to deal with the cop and not Gabby. Because he gave him like very little, he gave them very little room for the cop to come on that side. But, you know, who knows? Maybe it was calculated like that. But it did seem that he had a control in the situation and she was kind of emotionally breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, maybe she was dealing with a lot. Maybe there was a lot of stress. And that's the thing about these kind of domestic situations. Is that similar to, what was that case that just got a Netflix thing where the guy, you know, murdered his wife and his daughters?
Oh.
Where the guy's very calm, very much looks like he's in control. The wife is it looks like she's
it's,
a crazy one.
It's the Watts family.
Chris yeah. Watts. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, he was the one.
Do we, and yeah, I think we're going to get into the domestic dispute and yep. all of that. All right. Well, I'm not going to spoil it. Let's keep going. All right, and here is that 911 call.
Hi, can you hear me, sir?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hi, I'm calling. I'm right on the corner of Main Street by Moonflower, and we're driving by, and I'd like to report a domestic dispute in Florida with a white van, Florida license plate, white land, gentleman.
Where's
about
that?
5-6 years. They just drove off. They're going down Main Street. They made a right onto Main Street. From Moonflower.
Or what were they doing?
Cooperative, but, what'd you say?
What were they doing?
We drove by and the gentleman was slapping the girl.
He was slapping her?
Yes, and then we stopped. They ran up and down the sidewalk. He proceeded to hit her, hopped in the car, and they drove off.
Okay, you said it's a white van?
White van, I give you the license, but just give me one sec. I took a picture of it.
What kind of white van? Like a big one?
It was a smaller van with the license plate of, it was white, Florida license plate. It was, the make was a Ford, model was Transit, black ladder on the map.
Okay.
All right, so in that, we hear that it was actually Brian who was the one who was the aggressor. But when we see the body cam footage from the cop, it's Gabby saying that she was the one who was kind of acting out of control. She was the aggressor and he was the victim.
Yeah, which is what a lot of people have contemplated. It's like, okay, this is kind of what abusive relations are.
Right, like, she's covering for him.
Yeah, she's covering, doesn't want him to go to jail. You know, they obviously, the unfortunate thing is that they live this this social media life that they're trying to keep appearances up.
Right, okay. What's the next thing that we need to know?
The next thing that we need to know about all this, well, we need to go into the deeper dive of their social media. So, this next part is, you want to read that?
A deeper dive into their social media.
All right, good job. On September 11th, Gabby Petito's family filed a missing persons report with police in Suffolk County, New York for Gabby. Brian was identified as a person of interest in the case by Northport Police. The police said that Brian hadn't cooperated or spoken with officers during their investigation since he arrived back alone in Florida. He chose to plead the fifth. He was last seen on September 14th by family members. He told them that he was going on a hike in Florida's Carlton Reserve that day, and he hasn't been seen since. Not even 2 days ago, September 17th or 18th, there was an Instagram account named Gabby Petite 2 that commented on Brian's account that Gabby was alive and well. Social media users quickly went over to the account since it had posted stories. The posts were just messages claiming that she was Gabby, she was alive, please stop harassing Brian's family, she's back in civilization and will be back with her family soon. Gabby's body has since been found and the autopsy had determined her cause of death a homicide. This account has been made private and locked. So who made this account? People also noticed that Gabby's Spotify account had been updated back in September 1st with new songs. A playlist titled Self-Consumption was created the day after authorities believed she was missing. It's all songs about heartache and death. It should be noted that this account was used by the couple during the trip. Was this just a move to make it seem as if Gabby was still out there enjoying herself? Or was Brian just using the account because he could. People also noticed that her All Trails app location was set to Puerto Rico during this time. Again, was this to throw people off the trail or just someone using the apps because they can? A couple noticed that on August 27th, while filming their trip through the Grand Tetons, they had passed a white van that was just parked to the side. They only remember it because the license plate was from Florida. Then there was a few seconds that Brian accidentally may have gone live not too long ago. The short live stream seemed to have come from inside a boat. There have also been strange coincidences from past posts when both were still traveling. Brian caught reading a book titled Annihilation, which is a story of women going disappearing during a trip. Gabby's last post seeming like old pics because of her hair color. But is this just social media detectives trying to find more than there really is?
All right. So the book that he was reading was about women who were murdered in like the wilderness.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit strange. The self-consumption Spotify playlist, it was changed after Gabby had already been missing. So that seems like kind of maybe just a fumble on his part. I don't think it was Gabby, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think it was him just listening to Spotify thinking nothing of it.
Yes.
You know, you're on the run. You need some tunes.
Yeah.
And you think I'll just change the title.
Be fine. It's okay.
No one will know. Whatever.
Yeah.
You can't run without those tunes, I guess. I mean, you'd think if you did something like that, you'd be a little more careful, but I guess you just got to have your Led Zeppelin or whatever.
Well, it's interesting that it's self-consumption, which is like he's consumed with himself. And
right.
And this, if it is determined a homicide, it's a crime of ego. Obviously, this man believed that he was going to get rid of all this, be able to get away with it, going to be able to run, which he's not a hardened criminal. He's not a master
right,
murderer.
Which is why he's still listening to a Spotify playlist. Like, nobody would notice.
Exactly. You know, and then looking up trails in Puerto Rico, I bet he was looking them up because I think that's where he's kind of headed to.
Right.
You know, like, okay, well, I'll just go hiking while I'm there. Like, that's the mind of a, you know, we've talked about them, a sociopath.
Right. Because you didn't, it seems like it was probably a crime of passion because he didn't plan it out that well.
Yes.
So it seems to me like they got in some kind of fight and it, you know, got out of hand. We already know from the 911 call that he's an abuser.
Yeah.
And, you know, that goes further and further every time. You know, like at first they do it and they're sorry and then it gets worse the next time and worse and it builds up the more that you are tolerating it. And it's almost impossible to get away from that stuff. And that toxic those kinds of toxic relationships. So in my mind, it's definitely they got in a fight and it went further than it usually went. And then it's like, okay, I got to run.
Yes. Yeah, I think the interesting thing you showed me it was that video of those people passing the white van on the side where they had just seen it off the trail. And, you know, some people claim to see kind of an orb or whatever.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about the orb. So I had seen this video before they had found Gabby's remains. And I'd seen it. I thought nothing of it. It was a van passing their van. They were videotaping because they were like, oh, it's another van from Florida, which honestly, that's not a good enough reason to start videotaping in my book. It's like, whoa, Florida's a big state.
Yeah.
Anyway, but they were videotaping and a couple of days later, I saw the footage again and there were a lot of people in the comments saying, oh, did you see the orb? And I couldn't believe that I missed it before.
Yeah.
But there is definitely either an orb or a very orbish bug on the camera. And it seemed like not fly. To me, it wasn't flying in the way a bug would fly unless it was like stuck in a web. Kind of like a SOS signal.
It seemed very alerting, like, hey.
Yeah, it seemed like it was really trying to get your attention, like, darting very quickly. And so, if she had passed at that time, that definitely could be her spirit trying to reach out and say, I'm here. But we didn't know that she had passed at that time.
Yeah, nobody knew. And this couple didn't know either when they saw
it. And I think that in one of the videos of that same video of the orb, there is one of her shoes on the ground.
Oh, really?
Yeah. there's like one of her flip-flops on the ground where it's like, if you get in a struggle, that flip-flop's gone.
Yeah.
You know, like, a flip-flop, it bails out at any instance of...
of danger? Yeah, flip-flops are gone.
Flip-flops are very, very chicken. They no support whatsoever.
No. They don't even like running.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't like running. No. You're right. I lost a flip flop once. I just took a nap and it left.
It's like, we're in danger. You're sleeping.
It was like,
something
man,
can get us.
Yeah, it left a note and it was like, nah. It was like, you don't take care of me.
Oh man.
But yeah, there's other stories. Like there's another story of a person who claims to have picked up.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, do we have that?
I have that.
Oh, yes. Okay. Then I'm not going to talk about it. Let's keep going. All right. With these last bombs of information, before we're going to do last story announcements, which is just if you have a story, give it to us on... Give it to us!
Yes, stop holding it back.
On the Facebook group, the Instagram, or the website, all at True Scary Stories with Edie. Don't forget to give us 5 stars after this. We work so hard on this. Every time. Every time. We work so hard. But we love it, and we love you guys. Nick, do you have any announcements?
Yes. This Sunday at the North Hollywood, California Ha Ha Cafe, or Ha Ha Comedy Club, I'll be doing a last-minute show, 9 p.m., and Edie Gibson's going to be on it.
Oh, my goodness. I forgot.
And Alfred Robles.
Wait, this Friday?
This Sunday.
Oh.
At 9 p.m.
All right, guys. So if you're fans of us, then come out to the Ha Ha.
Yeah, and hit me up on social media. I'll give you free tickets.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll bring stickers.
Yes.
We totally will. All right, let's get to the current updates.
September 19th, human remains were discovered by the FBI during a search of Spread Creek Dispersed Camping Area in Wyoming's Bridger Teton National Forest. I said it right?
Teton? The Grand Tetons.
Oh, Tetons. September 20th, which is not even too long ago, FBI and police searched Brian Laundrie's home in Florida. His parents were also removed from the property, as it is now a crime scene. September 21st, autopsy results confirmed that the remains found Sunday in the Bridger Teton National Forest are those of Gabby Petito. The case is ongoing. Brian is still nowhere to be found. He also isn't charged with anything. Outside of his parents, almost no one has really come into contact with Brian since this all began happening. Almost no one. On August 29th in Wyoming, Miranda Baker says she and her boyfriend gave Brian a ride. Brian claimed he had been camping by himself for multiple days while Gabby was back at their van working on social media posts. In a series of videos posted on TikTok, Miranda Baker said she and her boyfriend picked up Brian that evening while he was hitchhiking in Coulter Bay, Wyoming. That's not far from where Gabby's remains were found. Brian offered to pay $200 for the ride before he even got into the vehicle. Miranda recalls Brian wearing a backpack, pants, hiking boots, looked clean and didn't smell bad, and was very polite. Brian told them he had been camping basically in the middle of nowhere at a site outside of the Grand Teton National Park near the Snake River. Brian claimed to have hiked for days along that river and that all he had was a tarp to sleep on. Once Brian found out that Miranda and her boyfriend were going to Jackson Hole instead of Jackson, he got agitated, asked that the vehicle stopped, and got out near the Jackson Dam. She said they dropped him off less than 30 minutes after picking him up. So those were the last people to bait.
Right. Okay. So the weird thing about this, too, is that the family, basically, when they knew she was missing, the family had said that they were pretty much in contact with Brian. They had him. The police thought he was at their house, and then they found out that he had actually not been seen in a few days.
Yeah, he'd been gone.
Right. So it seems like the parents were covering for him.
Yeah, and you know how I mentioned earlier
because why wouldn't they say, like, we don't know where he is?
Yeah. How I mentioned that Instagram account that just popped up that was Gabby Petite too?
Oh, yeah.
Some people were thinking, well, is that Brian's
mom? Right,
of
course it was. I forgot about that.
You know, so there's a whole lot of, like, things where it's, like, just bad people.
Right. It's also, it's very reminiscent of, like, two children in a trench coat, like, trying to, like, it's like, yo, this is so transparent. Like, your kid, two kids in a trench coat.
Yeah.
And then they open the trench coat, and one of them was a monkey, and they're like, no, we're a monkey, and a kid.
The whole time and a kid. You didn't even know. Look at the legs.
Yeah, you didn't even see the legs.
So, yeah. So, here with this story, we have Brian, who's kind of showing his sociopathic behavior by offering a major amount of money, right? Being polite when he was getting what he wanted, and then when he found out they weren't even going the way he wanted, got instantly agitated and just was like, leave me here.
Right. That is like the very Chris Watts-ish way to be too. When I was watching the videos of him, of Brian and Gabby, I was getting that very Chris Watts vibe, that vibe of someone who's in the background mostly.
Yeah.
And just kind of smiling and just like pretending to be calm and normal. I don't know how to describe it, but the same feeling I would get watching Chris Watts' footage.
Yeah, which is what a lot of people say, which, you know, I mean, maybe that is a weird sign, that weird politeness, I'm not gonna say anything.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, intuition. But the thing is, we all, when we get those intuitions, we just push them away because we're like, that doesn't make any sense. And it's not until afterwards that we're like, oh, I saw that. And it's like, okay, well, you know, like you didn't trust your intuitions.
And you know what it also is? A lot of people that are used to like causing trouble and causing fights and stuff like that, they know how to hold their aggression in when they're talking to authorities.
Like, yeah, just like what we saw in the body cam footage. Yeah. Now, another little interesting tidbit is that the pictures that were posted recently that were either pretending or maybe, I don't know, really, Gabby, I'm not leaning towards that. They showed her with her roots dyed blonde. And then, like, only a week before, she had black roots.
Yeah.
So that kind of doesn't make sense if you're a woman, you know, about, like, your roots and stuff. When you're on the road, you don't want to get your hair dyed blonde at any old place. Like, you have to match the color that you already have. So it seems like to me that was an old picture. And by the fact it was a Halloween picture.
In August.
Says like, oh, I took this picture last year. And they are posting it trying to pretend like they're me. And like it's like the Gabby Petito 2 thing. It's like, okay, how could it be any more transparent than that?
You know?
You're like, not Gabby Petito. This is like the only thing more transparent. It reminds me of when one of the girls who was on The Bachelor made a fake account and commented nice things under her own pictures. And then she forgot to log into the fake account.
Yeah.
And she was still logged into her account. So it was obvious that she made a fake account just to give herself compliments. It reminds me of like really bad cover-up.
Yeah.
It reeks.
But I will say my little beyond the reasonable doubt is that she may have posted it because she was not liking any pictures. So she's like, here's an old picture. Happy Halloween. You know, I just need to know. I know I need to post something.
Right. Or maybe she was feeling ugly.
Yeah.
Which everyone does.
Especially on the day that was the last time she was seen.
I thought you were going to say, especially you.
Oh, no.
especially you. I mean, how could you not? I don't get it.
Yeah.
How do you not wake up every day and just... Whoa. Yeah. So sometimes you do post older pics. I do that all the time when I just want to post something. And I'm like, oh, how come I never posted this pic?
Yeah.
So to play devil's advocate, that is a little maybe. But anyways, Nick, do you have anything else you want to say about this episode before we get out of here?
I hope you guys enjoyed it. We tried our best to find some very interesting missing cases.
We tried our best? We did.
We did. And, well, hold on. We tried our best and we accomplished it. 200%. See,
whoa.
You had to let me
finish.
Man.
Sorry. I should have let you finish.
But, you know, once again, the Gabby Petito case is very ongoing. It's still fresh. It's something that Edie brought to my attention. So hopefully you guys enjoyed hearing about it.
All right, guys. So we will see you on the Facebook group. We will see you on the Instagram, and we will see you on the website. Again, you know what else I'm going to do? There's also some other people who are missing that are not getting the same amount of coverage.
Oh, yes.
And I'm going to post an article on the group of some other people who are missing with their pictures. I wanted to talk about them in this episode, but then I was like, well, I can't post a picture of them in this episode. So yeah. I think it would be better if we posted the picture and then you could actually see the people.
Yeah.
Instead of me just describing them. So look for that. And we love you guys. And wash your hands. And give us 5 stars!